Hi, it's Diane. Great to be with you. I hope everyone out there enjoyed a wonderful Thanksgiving Day. On my mind this week, not surprisingly, food. A growing body of research points to the importance of the gut to our well-being. My first guest, Dr. Michael Mosley, explains the many different kinds of bacteria that live in the gut and how they affect our weight, our moods, and our overall health.
Probably 1,000 different species of bacteria, viruses, and other microbes, maybe 20 to 30 trillion of them, and together they have a massive impact.
He also tells us what foods to eat and avoid for better gut health. Then, author Isabel Allende. It's been more than 3 decades since her novel, The House of Spirits, catapulted her to literary stardom. She's just come out with her latest book. Though written before last year's election, it reads like commentary on some of the hottest political issues of the moment: immigration, the status of refugees, and violence against women.
When I wrote that, they must have been in the air. I don't think that Trump has invented anything. He's just picked up what was already there. He represents something that was under the surface and that in our civil society was sort of not allowed, like white supremacy, xenophobia, misogyny, and all that.
But first, Dr. Michael Mosley. His new book is called The Clever Gut Diet, How to Revolutionize Your Body from the Inside Out. He joins us from a BBC studio in London. Dr. Mosley, it's wonderful to have you with us again.
A real pleasure to be speaking to you.
Now, you know, the last time we talked, you were talking about the benefits of intermittent fasting, something you were an early proponent of and something that really has become much more widely appreciated today. But now you've become, as you say, rather obsessed with the gut and the gut-brain connection. Talk about why.
Sure. Now, the reason I got into intermittent fasting and I wrote a book, The Fast Diet, about it was because I'd discovered that I was a type 2 diabetic, like my dad, and I didn't want to go on medication. So I was looking for something which would effectively cure it. And that turned out to be intermittent fasting, something I called the 5-2 diet. And I lost 20 pounds on that, and my blood sugars have been completely normal without medication ever since. But I also got really interested around that time in the gut biome. That's the collection of bugs that live in your gut. Probably 1,000 different species of bacteria, viruses, and other microbes, maybe 20 to 30 trillion of them. And together they have a massive impact on your health. So I wanted to find out more about them, and I began researching them, which led to my current book.
Well, here's the thing that fascinates me, that these tiny bacteria in our gut can actually influence our decision-making about food. How does that work?
Yes, it is completely extraordinary. In fact, psychiatrists have a new term for it called psychobiotics, because it turns out that the microbes in your gut can influence your mood. And they do it 3 different ways. One way they do it is by generating and creating chemicals which are released into your bloodstream. And the thing about bacteria is they don't have arms and legs, but they are brilliant chemists. You just have to think of the ability yeast have to turn sugar into alcohol. So microbes are brilliant at chemistry, and they produce these substances which, as I say, travel through your blood to your brain and which influence your decision-making. But they can also hack into something called the vagus nerve. And this is a nerve that connects your brain, the one in your skull, with what's known as your second brain, which lives in your gut. And these are a mesh of neurons, as many brain cells down there as you would find in the head of a cat. And they are connected by this super fast broadband connection known as the vagus nerve. And it appears that the microbes, rather like cunning Russians, can hack into this system and by doing so influence your brain. It sounds like science fiction, but it's absolutely true.
It sure does. Now, I want to back up a minute. You're saying that the vagus nerve and the brains that are in the bacteria are about the same size that would fill the brain of a cat.
Yes, well, there's a fine mesh, which is also known as the enteric system, and it's known as the second brain, and it runs pretty well the whole length of your intestine. So it's not sort of crunched up as you'd find in your skull, but it is exactly the same brain cells you would find in your skull. And in fact, the majority of dopamine, which is the so-called feel-good hormone, which is widely distributed in your brain, well, your gut produces more than your brain. There is more, if you like, of that sort of activity going on in your gut than even in your skull. And as I said, if you took all the brain cells lining your gut, then they would add up to pretty much the brain capacity of a cat. And my cat is pretty clever, which is why I call the book Clever Guts, because your guts are remarkably clever.
Yeah. And it's this 2 to 4 pounds of microbes that live in the gut that are determining what we eat and what we do with what we eat.
It certainly contributes to it. I wouldn't say they are totally in command, but they do influence. They certainly also have a strong role to play in what gets absorbed from your food. Because the absorption takes place mainly in the small intestine, but quite a lot of it still makes its way down to the large intestine. That's the last 3 or 4 feet of gut, and that's where the vast majority of the microbes live. And when the food gets down there, and this is mainly the stuff which hasn't been absorbed higher up, that's what feeds those microbes. You can think of them a bit like a rainforest down there. It is as complex as a rainforest down there. And they are sort of feeding off these sort of fiber and bits of undigested food that make their way down. And they take these foods, what is left, and they absorb them, they turn them into chemicals, they use them to create chemicals, to fight each other, they use them to produce things like short-chain fatty acids, which in turn are actually, they affect our mood. We know that short-chain fatty acids, for example, are instrumental in how well we sleep. So it appears that the microbes in your gut help determine how well you sleep, which is extraordinary. There is this explosion of scientific knowledge which has taken place over the last 3 or 4 years, really, and we're beginning to understand just how influential these microbes are.
Help me to understand the connection between these microbes and how well we sleep.
Sure. As I said, what happens is we know now, there was a study done recently, that if you eat a diet which is rich in fiber, particularly a type of fiber known as an oligofructosaccharide, then people tend to sleep more deeply. Conversely, if you eat a diet rich in sugar and fat, it's likely you will sleep more lightly. There was quite a big study done on this recently. And the hypothesis, if you like, is that what's happening is this fiber is going down to feed the so-called good bacteria in your gut. They in turn produce a chemical which goes into your blood supply, which goes to your brain, which helps you to sleep better. They've also demonstrated that the bacteria in your gut can influence your risk of a stroke, that they produce this substance which can lead to weakening of the blood vessels in the brain, which in turn increase your risk of stroke. So they're doing all sorts of strange and mysterious things which we were completely unaware of. And their influence is very, very pervasive, and not just the brain, but the immune system and your weight and things like that.
Let's talk about weight, because that's something a great many people are concerned about, and how the microbiome really regulates body weight.
Absolutely. Now, one of the key ways it appears to do so is that we don't 100% absorb the calories we eat. We, you know, excrete quite a few of them. And how much of the calories you consume, you absorb, and how much you excrete is at least partly down to the mix of microbes in your gut. So they did a study recently where they took some feces samples from overweight individuals and lean individuals and basically fed them to mice. And those mice were in turn, you know, fed a normal mouse diet. But it turned out that those who had been fed feces from people who are overweight put on hugely more weight than those who had been fed feces from slim people, despite eating exactly the same number of calories. And when they looked at, you know, what the mice in turn were excreting, it turns out that the ones who were putting on weight were basically absorbing more of the calories. So that is one way the microbes seem to be doing what they're doing. And that's arousing a lot of interest in the moment. And the other way they appear to do what they do is by, as I said, influencing to some degree your food choices.
So,
and again, that is because they're kind of down there. And if they are the sort that, you know, if you like, thrive on a high sugar diet, then they're going to want you to eat a high sugar diet, and they can influence you in that way.
So everybody's biome is different then, and you could feed the same kinds of food to different people, and because of that biome, they would react differently. Is that correct?
Absolutely right. And some of them would put on more weight than others while eating the same number of calories. The other thing we know is the biome strongly influences your blood sugar response to a meal. So I could eat bread and my blood sugars shoot up. You might eat bread and yours don't shift at all because you have a different biome to me. So what we do know about the biome is that a healthy biome is a very diverse one. It's one where there is a huge range of different microbes down there. And the thing we also know is that over the last 30 or 40 years, the microbiome has become depleted in America, Australia, the UK, and places like that. When they look at it, the sort of range of microbes down there, and in particular, the sort of microbes which are known as the old friends, seem to be in short supply. And these are the microbes that have evolved with us and are incredibly important for our health. But I'm afraid they're on the decline.
I would also, if I were listening to this conversation, I'd be wondering how I could change my biome.
Absolutely. So my book, Clever Guts, is really all about that. It's about the science of what's going on, but it's also about the ways in which you can improve the quality of your biome. And as I said, this is kind of based on the latest science. So there, I go through the sort of foods which are likely to improve it. They tend to be quite fiber-rich foods because the average American eats about a third of the amount of fiber they should. There are foods which broadly go into what's known as the Mediterranean diet, but I'm also encouraging people to try fermented foods, which I think people are becoming more aware of. And these are not just yogurt and cheese, which are fermented foods, but things like kefir, sauerkraut, and foods like that, which tend to be more East European or Asian in origin, but where it turns out they have a very positive influence on the biome.
Yogurt is something I want to ask you about. I have been eating non-fat yogurt for a long time. You're encouraging people to eat full-fat yogurt. Why is that?
Absolutely, because there's actually been quite a lot of big studies which have shown that the consumption of full-fat yogurt is much more beneficial than zero-fat yogurt, that actually people put on less weight. And it could be it's because the full-fat yogurt keeps you more satiated. It's also there will be sort of fat-soluble elements in the yogurt, which you would lose once you've removed the fat. I also think that when you, particularly if you make the yogurt yourself, then it's going to be full of sort of rich and beneficial bacteria. Whereas if you buy the, you know, the low-fat, zero-fat yogurt, unfortunately, it's undoubtedly been heavily processed. So I suspect there's very little beneficial living in it. And so, yeah, I used to be also a sort of low-fat yogurt eater, but or yogurt eater even. But I switched recently because I kind of looked at the science, and to be honest, I also prefer the flavour. And I try to have it without sugar. I have it with blueberries and blackberries.
Yes.
Because we know that sugar kills microbes. And we want to consume those healthy microbes, particularly in things like yogurt and smelly French cheeses, because they're sort of lactobacillus, and other types of bacteria tend to be, they've been shown to be very good for the gut.
Now, one of the items that's gotten a bad rap in the last few years is red meat. And you're saying that red meat is actually part of a good and a healthy diet.
Absolutely. Now, I am fully in sympathy with people who are vegetarians and vegans, because most of them are doing it for ethical reasons, and I, you know, pat them on the back. But actually, there is pretty good evidence that red meat, particularly when it is grass-fed, is absolutely fine and probably beneficial. It's incredibly rich in vitamins and iron, and an awful lot of Americans are iron depleted. The thing is that if you get the sort of red meat which is cheap and has been force-fed, if you like, in some of those giant silos down in Texas, in the States, I'm afraid to say, a lot of beef is fed growth hormones, it's fed antibiotics, things which are banned in the UK. And red meat like that, I wouldn't be crazy about, because one of the problems for the microbiome, the healthy bacteria in our guts, is that over the last 30 or 40 years, they have been blasted by antibiotics. We take a lot of antibiotics, not just for our health, but also we absorb them from animals, because animals have been fed huge amounts of antibiotics because they know that leads to growth promotion. So I am a fan of red meat, but I prefer my meat sort of grass-fed. I eat less of it because it's obviously, or tends to be, more expensive. But I think I'm going for quality rather than quantity.
Tell us about people who have certain autoimmune diseases like asthma or eczema or inflammatory bowel disease, which has become more and more common these days. How can changing your gut help with those?
Absolutely. It's really striking, the incredible growth in these allergic autoimmune diseases, which would include celiac disease, and rates of celiac, of where you're intolerant to gluten, have quadrupled in the States in the last 40 years. Now, one explanation for this is what they call the old friends hypothesis. And what that says is that we have these microbes in our gut, known as the old friends, that evolved with us over the last hundreds of thousands of years. And one of their roles, particularly early on in life, is to train your immune system what to respond to, what is friend, what is foe. It's a bit like granny bringing up the kids. You know, you've got these unruly teenagers who don't quite know what to do, and they're in danger of trashing the house. Now, if you don't have these microbes in your gut, then what happens is your immune system goes a little bit crazy. It is more hyperactive. It attacks lots of things which are not actually harmful. And the result is the rise of, as I said, autoimmune diseases, which would include things like Crohn's, irritable bowel, celiac disease, and asthma and eczema. They are linked to the depletion of the old friends. So one way to help you is to reintroduce some of these old friends back into your life via diet, and sometimes just through things like gardening. If you go outside and embrace the outdoors, then you're going to be exposed to a kind of range of microbes. And it's best, frankly, if this is done earlier in life, but at any point in life, there seems to be evidence. There's also some research suggesting the judicious use of probiotics. And in the book, I do go into the specific species, if you like, that have shown to be beneficial, because there are, as I said, 1,000 different types of microbe out there in your gut. And you need the right ones if you're going to try and treat anything which, you know, looks like an allergic disease, because some will work, some will absolutely not work. The evidence at the moment is still preliminary, but I have been eating quite a lot of fermented foods, as I mentioned, and normally I get terrible hay fever, but this year I haven't had a sniffle. So that is anecdotal, but I'm very pleased.
Dr. Mosley, you mentioned gardening, and what you surmise is that as a society, we may have become too clean with all these antiseptic wipes and the like.
Absolutely. Now, this used to be one of the explanations for the rise of all these allergies. It was called the hygiene hypothesis, and what it said is we're not exposed to enough bugs. This has been refined into what I call the old friends hypothesis, because there are plenty of bugs out there you do not want to be exposed to, such as cholera, typhoid, malaria, things which really aren't going to do you any good at all. What you want are those microbes which are actually healthy for the gut. And the place you get them from is you get them from your mother's breast milk, which is why breastfeeding is so good for you. You get them from your mother as you come down her birth canal, which is again why children born by cesarean section are at hugely greater risk of developing allergies later in life. And you kind of keep them if you don't get exposed to too many antibiotics. Because again, what the antibiotics do is they may save your life, but they are in danger of wiping out a lot of your gut bacteria, the good, the bad, and the ugly. So, you know, if one can keep the antibiotics at bay, then, you know, particularly when you're young, then do. And you may benefit from taking a probiotic at the same time, or your child may benefit. As I said, it's a fascinating area of research, which has got me terribly, terribly excited.
I do have to ask you about infecting yourself with a worm. Your wife wasn't too happy about that.
No, she was surprisingly tolerant. This was an experiment I did a while ago in which I decided to infect myself with a tapeworm, a beef tapeworm, and I actually went to Kenya and swallowed some cysts and ended up growing 3 tapeworm in my gut, which were about 2 to 3 meters long. The deal with my wife is I would get rid of them before they were fully grown. And I did it as part of an experiment in which we were testing what I call the old friends hypothesis, because along with the sort of, you know, rather nice bacteria, there is evidence that tapeworm and things like that, which have lived with us, again, for hundreds of thousands of years, one of their roles is to suppress the immune system. So we know that in parts of the world where there is heavy infestation of worm, there are very low rates of allergic disease. So they infected me with a worm, and indeed we did see changes in my immune response, particularly to things like pollen, which I'm very sensitive to. But when I had the worm inside me, I wasn't. So it was an unpleasant experiment, but it was certainly memorable. And I didn't lose any weight. People think, you know, if you eat you swallow tapeworm, you're going to kind of... I didn't, no.
Oh, well, I want to know whether you're still using intermittent fasting. And I want to know whether a breakfast and a lunch and then fasting for the rest of the day and night is equally as effective as fasting from morning until evening.
So I'm doing intermittent fasting one day a week. And interestingly, there is a connection between intermittent fasting and the health of your gut. And this has been discovered very recently, that intermittent fasting encourages the growth of a particular type of bacteria called Akkermansia. And Akkermansia lives in the wall of your gut, and it lives on mucus. So what happens is it's not dependent on the food you're eating. So when you stop eating for a while, its competitors get weakened and it grows stronger. And we know that Akkermansia is associated with leanness, and it's also associated with strengthening the wall of your gut, which means that you are less likely to develop something called leaky gut syndrome, where the contents of your gut might leak through into your blood. So Akkermansia is seen as one of the really good guys or gals. It's a type of bacteria which is seen as very, very healthy. And as I said, intermittent fasting boosts the levels of that. So I'm kind of doing that. But your second question, yes, I think any period of time where you go without food for 12 to 14 hours, there is clear evidence of benefit. And I've been talking to an old friend of mine, Professor Mark Mattson, who's at the National Institutes on Aging. And I believe he was on your show with me about 3 or 4 years ago.
Yes.
And he is one of the sort of, he's one of the gurus, the kings of intermittent fasting. And I know that he skips breakfast and lunch, and he only has an evening meal. That's his strategy, and he's doing it. He's quite a slim individual, but he's doing it because he studies Alzheimer's, and he's convinced that intermittent fasting is likely to delay the onset of dementia, that it seems to be good for the brain. So that seems to be his motivation, and that's his particular protocol. I sort of flip around a bit, but I do stick to it at least one day a week. And as I said, I'm delighted to say that for 5 years since I started it, and I was a type 2 diabetic, I've never had a flicker of problem since. My blood sugars are completely normal, and I'm incredibly grateful for that.
Well, I do want to let our listeners know you have many recipes in this book as well, ways to keep that gut healthy.
Thank you.
Dr. Mosley, thank you so much for joining us. Great to talk to you again.
Absolutely lovely to talk to you as well.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now for a quick break. And we're back. Isabel Allende's new novel, In the Midst of Winter, tells the story of three people whose lives become intertwined during a snowstorm in New York City. Each carries burdens from the past, including scars from gang violence and political upheaval. It's the story of struggle and resilience and, as is the case in most of her work, love. Well, Isabel, how wonderful to hear your voice again.
It's wonderful to be with you, like always.
You begin the book with a quote from Albert Camus. Can you read it for us and tell us why you began the book that way?
Well, the quote speaks to my heart. And it says, in the midst of winter, I finally found in me an invincible summer. And to me, that quote means a lot because I have gone through emotional winters in my life and political winters, too, that have been very long. But I always had the certainty that there is an invincible summer waiting somewhere to emerge. And this is the story of the book, three people who are living in an emotional winter, and they find through an adventure that they share, they find solidarity, compassion, friendship, humor, and eventually love.
They are really three traumatized characters, and they're trapped together in a snowstorm in New York. Tell us a little about each of them.
Richard is a professor at NYU, a man that is in his 60s, early 60s. He has a safe life. He's insured against everything. He's vegan. He has 4 cats. He doesn't want anything to happen to him, and he's totally protected. And therefore, he's half dead because you can't live without risk. But he's guarding himself from the memories of the past. And from a terrible feeling of guilt that he carries around.
Indeed.
Yeah. Then Lucia is, he owns a brownstone in Prospect Heights in Brooklyn. And he's renting the apartment in the basement to a colleague who is a professor that has been invited to teach for a year to lecture at NYU, and she's a Chilean female journalist who lived through the military coup in Chile in 1973, had to go into exile, return eventually to her country, and wrote about the brutality of the repression of the 17 years of the dictatorship. And she's particularly interested in the fate of those people who were arrested and disappeared, because that was what happened to her brother. Mm. And the third person is a young woman, undocumented immigrant from Guatemala, who lives in hiding and in silence. And during this storm, this blizzard in New York, which really happened in January last year, there's a minor car accident in which Richard rear-ends the car that the Guatemalan girl Evelyn is driving, and that seems like nothing is the starting point for a huge adventure.
Indeed. And Evelyn is a young undocumented immigrant from Guatemala. She flees her country after her two brothers are killed, and she has been raped by members of the gang MS-13. Isabel, I have never read a more vivid account of the challenges one faces fleeing a country like Guatemala with the aid of someone who's been paid to help. Describe for us, if you would, the research you did on that part of the book to help us understand how treacherous, how dangerous that trip is.
Well, I did research, but I didn't need to research too much because I have a foundation. And one of the themes of my foundation, what we do, is work with undocumented immigrants and refugees in the United States, but in other places in the world as well. And when we think of refugees or immigrants, we think of numbers. 68,000 minors crossed the border looking for their parents 2 years ago. 68,000 doesn't mean anything. But when we give a face, a name, and a story to each one of those kids, then everything changes. And that is what my foundation does. We deal with individual cases through organizations that work with them in the field. And so I have cases that we have seen that are like Evelyn. But sometimes the reality is so much worse that I have to cut back when I write it, a novel, because the reader will not believe it. And the first responsibility of a fiction writer is to make the story believable. So in the case of Evelyn, I describe more or less what happened to her and her brothers, but I don't go into the details of what the gangs do.
But on the other hand, you do describe the journey that Evelyn must undergo, the fear she experiences, the fear of death. I mean, in the end, she's almost curled up fetus-like, not knowing what's coming next.
Well, that journey for Evelyn is not that bad as it is for other people, because she doesn't have to ride the trains. That is the most dangerous part of the journey. Some migrants have to ride on top of cargo trains, holding on to nothing, really, and they are attacked by the police, by gangsters, by bandits of all sorts, and sometimes even by the smugglers. Many of them fall off the train, and they lose their limbs if they don't lose their lives. One of the things of the organizations that my foundation supports is a woman that picks up these wounded people that have fallen from the train and takes care of them in an abandoned tortilla factory. That's the level of poverty and of absolute horror that these people encounter. We don't know anything about that, but some people have researched it very well. One person is Sonia Nazarios. She wrote Enrique's Journey, and she follows a kid that rides the trains and comes to the United States to be deported many times before he makes it, looking for his mother, by the way. She also has a TED Talk in which she talks about the migration problem from the roots, why people would leave everything they love, everything that is familiar to them, if they are not running for their lives in despair.
You know, Isabel, Lucia, like yourself, experienced the coup in Chile in 1973. So there, I wonder how much of your own experience you were able to put into the book.
Well, there is a lot of me in Lucia, but she's not the model for the character. I have a friend whom I thought of to create the character, a journalist in Chile. But Lucia has a lot of me because she has part of my personality. She's bossy. She's vain. She's romantic. She's always ready to fall in love. She's impulsive, willing to take risks, and loves adventure. So in that sense, she sort of resembles me. Also, she has no waist. And she looks at herself in the mirror and says, oh, who is this person? Doesn't even recognize herself. She's also in her early 60s. I think that she has much more zest for life than Richard, and she's the one who pulls the adventure together.
Indeed.
And who brings him out of his shell and forces him to be in the world. And so everything changes for him, but for both of them.
But, of course, the coup in 1973 that brought Augusto Pinochet to power, overthrowing Salvador Allende. Actually, he was your father's first cousin, is that correct?
Yes.
And eventually you were added to the government's most wanted list and began receiving death threats. Tell us about that part of your life.
I was not particularly threatened. Many people were. I was in a blacklist. Many people were in blacklists. And it was much safer. I mean, probably the only safe thing to do was to get out. But it's very hard to make that decision. So it took me a while. It took me a year to decide to leave. And I always thought that I could come back, that I would be taken out of the list at some point and I could return. But that didn't happen as soon as I thought. And eventually, my husband and my kids reunite with me in Venezuela, where we lived for 13 years before I moved to the United States. And by the time we had democracy in Chile again, and I returned I didn't return to live there because my family, my husband, my son, my grandchildren, they were all here. So that is the fate of my generation that lived the coup. We were starting our lives. I was 30 years old. I had two little kids, a career, and then something happened that the military coup that forced me to go in another direction and start from scratch in another place and become somebody else.
Becoming somebody else. How do you do that? What kind of transformation needed to take place inside you for you to become somebody else?
You know, circumstances force the change. It's not that you want it. When I got to Venezuela, none of the work I had done as a journalist was of any use. Nobody knew me. I had no connections. I had no money. I didn't have a job. And I felt that my life was going nowhere, that I was a total failure. My husband found a job in far away in a province, so I lived alone in Caracas with my kids. And in those years, I think that what initiated the transformation for me was the realization that I am much more resilient and stronger than I thought I was. And I think this happens to everybody. When we are tested is when we know who we are really. And I was just a spoiled brat. That at some point in my life I had to turn into a woman and face a new life. And it's not a bad thing. That eventually led to writing, and I became a writer that probably I would not be today if I had stayed in Chile. I would be a journalist like you, and a very happy one.
When you began writing in the midst of winter, Donald Trump was not even a candidate, but by the time he became president in November, I gather the book was done. So
yes,
it's not related to him. But what is your feeling about the steps he has taken on immigration policy?
There are several issues in the book that today seem very timely. And when I wrote that, they must have been in the air. I don't think that Trump has invented anything. He's just picked up what was already there. He represents something that was under the surface and that in our civil society was sort of not allowed, like white supremacy, xenophobia, misogynia, and all that. But it was there. We failed to see it. And he gave a megaphone to those sentiments. And that's where we are living now. So immigration is one of the points, but there's also domestic violence. There's many other things in the book that I wasn't thinking of Trump. He didn't exist in my horizon yet when I wrote the book. And today I think that in a way the book is timely and it addresses those issues. And I hope that if some readers can connect emotionally, for example, to Evelyn and to her plight, they might change their way of thinking about immigration.
What is your greatest fear about the country and where it's headed now?
I have lived the military coup in Chile. We were the most solid and longest democracy in the continent, and in 24 hours we lost it. And I'm afraid that in the United States we take a lot of things for granted. And we just relax. We think that our institutions are strong enough to withstand the assault that they are suffering right now. But maybe they're not. My greatest fear is that we have fascist elements in the society that, given the wrong circumstances, may take over. I think that we are living a long political winter. But I also believe that the invincible summer is under the surface. But the damage can take very long to undone.
Well, that takes me back to the novel, because in the midst of winter, your newest book is also a love story between people who thought the romantic part of their lives were over. Now, I want to ask you, Isabel, about the dedication in your book for unexpected love. Can you talk about that?
Well, it's dedicated to Roger Cochras, the unexpected love that landed on my lap a year ago. Also, that happened after I had written the book. I wrote the book imagining a love affair between two people in their 60s. And before, I had written The Japanese Lover, in which the couple is in their 80s. So obviously, the theme of mature love or old love has been in my mind for some time. Now I'm 75, and at 72, I divorced from my husband, with whom I had been for 28 years. And of course, I thought, well, the rest of my life, I will be very happy with my dog in a little house, and my family and my team of people who work with me, the foundation. It's a great life. I had nothing to complain about. But emotionally, it was sort of a winter in my life. And then one day, this guy, Roger, who is a lawyer in New York, in Manhattan, was driving to Boston, heard me on NPR, and didn't like what I had to say, so he wrote to my office. And my assistant replied very politely, and then he wrote again the next day. And then I replied. And we started corresponding. I don't know, it was not at all an important correspondence, but every single day for 5 months, he would write to me a good morning note and send a photograph of his cappuccino or something, and a good night note. And I became addicted. I would get up in the morning, Diana, I would get up in the morning and run to the phone to see if I had a message. And the message was not something philosophical or romantic or very spiritual. No, it was just good morning. And then after 5 months, I came to New York for a gala that I had to do for the Center for Reproductive Rights, and we met. He invited me out for lunch, and I looked at him, I liked him, and I said, what are your intentions? Because I am 74 years old, I don't have any time to waste. The poor man choked on the ravioli, you may imagine, because I mean, you should never mention commitment of any kind in front of an American male. But he reacted well and with great courage. He swallowed the ravioli, and from then on, we have been a couple, really, although I'm in California and he's in New York. So now he sold his house, got rid of everything he possessed, and is moving to my house with his clothes and a bike in December.
Isabel.
That takes courage. That takes courage.
What a great story.
You know, it takes courage because he says, if it doesn't work, I'll be homeless, he says. And he will.
And you may know that after being widowed 2.5 years ago, I have just remarried.
I know.
At age 81.
That's fantastic.
So you...
Fantastic.
You and I are indeed exploring summer in what might have been a long winter.
Yeah, but you know, Diane, people keep asking me, how is it to fall in love at 75? And I keep saying, it's exactly the same as falling in love at 17. But it's exactly the same, but with a sense of urgency. You don't have time to waste.
Yes.
You cannot waste time in petty little things, in jealousy, in little games that people play. You have to go to the core, to the essence of who the other person is and what the relationship is about and what love is about. And I'm telling you, if I had known this before, when I was younger, maybe I wouldn't have 2 divorces behind me.
You know, I understand exactly what you mean. Let me move on now to questions about Chilean poet Pablo Neruda. A few weeks ago, researchers announced he did not die of cancer. His former driver had said he was murdered. Do you have any thoughts about that? Because I know you actually knew him.
I have thoughts, but I don't have any information that has not been in the press. There is no proof yet that he was poisoned, but it is very possible. At the time, he died 11 days after the military coup. And Pablo Neruda, the day of the coup, received telegrams, because at the time that was a milieu of communication, from all over the world, Switzerland, Germany, everywhere in the world, countries, governments, people in particular, were offering him asylum and asking him to leave the country and go to Mexico or to Germany or wherever. For the military, he would have been a voice, a very, very powerful voice against the dictatorship abroad. They didn't want that. And probably they eliminated him as they eliminated the former president, Eduardo Frei, the president who had been the president of Chile before Salvador Allende, who could have been a democratic alternative to the military. So he was also in a hospital, in a clinic, and he went through a minor surgery and never recovered, and he was poisoned. Now it's proven that he was killed. The same thing could have happened to Pablo Neruda, but we don't have the proof yet. They say that it takes a year for the tests.
I gather his body has now been exhumed, and they are testing it for cause of death.
Yeah.
You, as I said, actually knew Neruda, and he gave you some advice once, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. I didn't pay any attention at the time, but now I know he was right. I was a journalist in Chile and a month and a half before the coup, in August of 1973, Pablo Neruda, who had already received the Nobel Prize and was living in his house in the beach in Isla Negra, 2 hours from Santiago, and he invited me to his house. So I went thinking that I would interview him as a journalist. He offered me a beautiful lunch with fish and white wine. And then it was getting dark because August in Chile is winter, the depth of winter. And so I said, look, Don Pablo, I really have to go, so let's do the interview. I don't want to drive in the darkness. And he said, what interview? And I said, well, I came to interview you. And he said, oh, no, I would never allow you to interview me. You are the worst journalist in this country. You lie all the time. You can never be objective. And if you don't have a story, you make it up. Why don't you shift to literature, where all these defects are virtues?
Wow.
He was right. He was right.
But you had to have been, I mean, how did you feel when you heard him say those words?
A little humiliated, because I thought when he invited me to his house, I thought it was for an interview, and I thought he must think that I'm the best journalist
exactly.
in this country if he calls me to his house in Isla Negra to talk with him. And look at the what he
look
said.
Look at what happened.
Yeah, I was really humiliated.
Well, Isabel Allende, you are a wonderful, wonderful writer of literature.
You.
And I'm so glad to have had the chance to talk with you again.
Oh, thank you so much. And good luck in this new love in your life.
And good luck to you as well.
We should talk again to see how it works.
Indeed. Absolutely. We will do that. Lots of love to you.
Same to you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
And that's it for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show this week was produced by Allison Brody and Sandra Baker. Our engineers are Timothy Olmsted and Jake Cherry. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.